Well, good morning. It's good to see a few faces of actually live people, or maybe semi-live people in front of me. I would like to encourage a few more of you who are listening in, who are online, to consider coming on next Sunday morning. It would be a great encouragement to me. It's my last Sunday in speaking in this church. But I think it would be a great encouragement for your worship team, for those who put a lot of effort and energy and planning into having these worship services. So we commit ourselves to following proper protocols. Let me say, if you came to church, you'd be a whole lot safer than you probably are going to several other places that you go to every week in your life. So just consider coming. It would be an encouragement to each other as well as to us here as a church. Well, it's Father's Day. And I've been thinking a lot about it. I walk 3 days a week with a group of guys that were part of a Healthy Heart program, or were part of a Healthy Heart program. We've kept it up going ourselves. And so I took some time to ask them some questions about being dads. But I also looked some up, and I thought about, so what does it mean to be a dad? And I came across a few responses. Ray Romano, probably some of you remember Ray Romano from, forget the name of the show, but he says, having children is like living in a frat house. Nobody sleeps, everything is broken, and there's a lot of throwing up. Jerry Seinfeld, you probably know him, he says, having a two-year-old is like having a blender, but you don't have the top for it. I like this one. It says, as Steve Martin said, a father carries pictures around where his money used to be. And a strong emphasis on used to be, because you no longer have money to put there. I realize that in the course of my lifetime, there's been significant events in my life that radically changed my life, often in ways that I could never have anticipated. And of course, one was getting married, and all of you who are married, and after a while you realize, okay, your life has taken a different direction. There's a whole lot of different things you now have to consider because you're married than when you were single and kind of running your life on your own. But I think a major event in my life is when we had children, when we decided to have children. And for us, that was at first a bit of a difficult process, because we eventually discovered that we were unable to have our own children. So we'd been married for a number of years, so we actually decided, well, you know what? Maybe we should try parenting, you know, kind of like borrowing kids, so to speak, for a little while, to see if we're good at it and actually even want kids around 24/7. Because of course, once you have children, it's not like kind of buying something at the store and decide you don't like it, you can send it back. So we decided, well, what better thing to do than to become foster parents? And so we applied and went through the interview process. It was a whole lot simpler at that time. And I remember sitting in the social worker's office as we were going through this one interview, and we began talking about children that we would take in. And I very naively looked at her and I said, you know, could you please send us as normal kids as possible? Because we're not sure we're ready to handle a whole lot of problems. She looked at me and like, what kind of rock did you crawl out from under? And said, Mr. Dick, she said, just the very fact that we have children that we're removing from a home, no matter how dysfunctional it is, they aren't normal. And we discovered that. But we had a blast taking in foster children. But I can remember one time when where now we had Jonathan, and he was about 2 or 3 years old, and I can remember when it struck me, well, life, this part of life is forever changed. And that was, we decided to take a vacation where normal route was to go down the coast, and we'd go camping, and we'd stay. We had a place down Cannon Beach long before it became like this touristy spot that was overpriced in Oregon. And we stayed in this little family-run motel that was right on the beach. And our MO was to, cook our meals there and kind of enjoy the ocean and sit there and watch the water. And then at midnight, often, you know, especially if it was a moonlit night, we would go for a romantic walk on the beach. It also instructed us that, oh, we got a two-year-old sleeping back in the room. I guess we can't go for that walk. Same as the places we stopped to eat. We used to kind of pull into some of the taverns because the food was good and you have a jug of beer and just enjoy that time and realize, oh, they don't let two-year-olds in here right now. Radically changes your life. And you only begin to discover as time goes on how radically it changed your life. I'm not big on titles, but one title that I have come to appreciate is the title of Daddy. And I remember when I finally completed my ordination and my daughter was, I think, about 4 or 5 years old, 5 years old at the time, I think, four, five. And she came up with her own title for me, which was, I was the most holy reverend father pastor daddy. And I thought, well, that fits. And the great thing about that is no matter all the titles that you can add to a person's name, there's a limited amount of people who can call you daddy. And it's very significant to me. So I asked some guys, what is the best thing that has happened to you? You know, what has been the best thing about being a dad? And, you know, they would kind of give some of the standard ones, and that was like watching your children grow up and celebrating their accomplishments along the way and taking satisfaction in how they were developing and their own sense of gifts and individuality. I think bar none was meeting your child for the first time. I can remember with both my kids the first time I held them. And quite honestly, when I first held Jonathan, I didn't realize I was going to be his daddy. And I can still remember what I was looking at. He was born with some serious medical issues, and they had to keep him under a certain amount of sedation as well as had his head shaved because they need to do ECGs quite regularly on him. And I kind of looked at him, and I thought, this little kid has got a face only a mother could love. He turned out to be quite a handsome young man later. But I remember my daughter especially. And she was born while I was actually out on a line run. We were living in Regina, and I was out in Wawota, Saskatchewan when she was born. And I called her, and we talked for a little while over the phone. And I couldn't wait to get in the next day. It was a Friday night. I couldn't wait to get in the next day on a Saturday so I could go see her. And I remember walking the halls with this little baby who had a mop of hair that was exceeded any kind of hair that I had on my head. And she kept staring at me. And I'm thinking, she's trying to figure out who this guy is. But I had a conversation I hope she still remembers. Because I talked about all the things that were going to happen in her life, about all the guys she would come across, and how they'd have to talk to me first. But it was a very special moment in my life when I held her for the first time. I think whenever I also think about the special things about being a dad, it's those random expressions of love that children give to you and express to you for no apparent reason, not prompted, for nothing other than they just love you. But it also gives rise to asking the question, what is the most difficult thing that you faced in being a dad, as I talk to guys? And they share different hard experiences that they'd had along the way. I came across one quote that I thought, well, this really applies to at least my son, because this guy said he's looking for danger at all times. We're just trying to keep him alive. And with Jonathan, that was a challenge at times, right from young on, because he was just a risk taker and something he felt, we're just trying to keep this kid alive. But I think the hardest thing that I would say is learning to let go. And you discover that parenting is a long life of an 18-year-old process of learning to let go. And sometimes the difficult part of it is letting them make some decisions on their own. And you got to bite your tongue awfully hard because you think, okay, that one's just not going to work out all that well. But you have to let your children grow and learn for themselves along the way. got to say, also seeing my car disappear down the road for the first time without me in it was also a very difficult thing to do. I'm grateful that my daughter is a great driver, probably better than most other people that I've ever met in terms of driver. But there are some difficulties along the way. But then this question came, how did you learn about being a dad? You know, you don't just kind of automatically know what to do as a dad. It can be a very intimidating thing when all of a sudden you hold this little baby and realize, oh no, what am I in for? You know, I there's a tremendous amount of responsibility that I have now. I like one guy said, he says, well, there's no real class. He says, they don't check to make sure you're prepared. I had to go through more training to drive the car home from the hospital than I did to have a baby for the rest of my life. And it's really true. You know, for some of the most significant things in our lives, like getting married and having children, we just make a decision and we do it. And then for some of the less momentous things, we have to go through like 6 months to a year of training and experiences and learning. Mark Twain said about his dad, and you know, one of the things that you learn about being a dad is that sometimes, and of course, if you're really pretty ignorant, you're actually smarter than they think they are, because Mark Twain said when he was 14, he couldn't believe how ignorant his old man was, that he hardly could stand being around him. But then when he reached the age of 21, he says he couldn't believe how much his old man learned in 7 years. And it is a long sense process of learning. I asked one of the buddies that I walk with, and he says, his name is Don as well. I said, how did you learn how to be a dad, Don? And he was one of the older guys. He says, I dated the same girl too long. In other words, I got married and had kids and all of a sudden had to learn. One guy said, by osmosis. And isn't that true? We absorb, we learn a lot of things that are more caught than taught. There isn't probably a seminar or workshop that will teach you as much as the home in which you grew up. That can be a problem, can't it? Because if you grow up in a dysfunctional home with a dysfunctional father, you run the risk of becoming a dysfunctional dad yourself, because you have some default settings that you need to change. When I look back at my experience, and I think about my dad was an awesome guy. To this day, I have the greatest amount of respect and admiration for the man who gave his life, sacrificed a lot to be a missionary, to follow God's out into a very unreached area of the world at that time. But he had lost his dad early in his life. His dad had been killed when he was in Russia. He and his older brother had to bury him and then escape with their lives, eventually ending up in Canada as refugees. And he often said his childhood came to an abrupt end at about 12 years old, where from that day on he had to learn how to live as a man. I think consequently my dad really did not know a lot about how to father. I never doubted his love for me. He was not a very expressive person. I don't remember him saying very often, if at all, the words, I love you. But I never doubted. I hear about people and talk to people who don't hear those words and they feel unloved. I never felt unloved by my dad. I knew that he would do anything for me. He would literally stop a bullet for me if he had to. He was a good provider and he was good. A good dad in many different ways. But he really did not know how to spend time with us as kids. And in fact, I learned, and I've shared this experience in the past, how much are we as dads, and my dad in this case, affected my understanding of God as my father. And I realized I needed to switch things around, because my image of God as my father was deeply influenced by my relationship with my dad, which again wasn't terribly negative, but I'll come to that in a minute. But I needed to understand that God, and this is what I want to talk about here throughout today, the rest of the sermon in a few minutes, God as my father becomes the model for me for fatherhood which is turning it around a little bit, but makes it a little bit more practical and valuable in my life. What I came to realization when it came to my image that I had as God, as my father, was that my dad was a field chairman, traveled a lot, so he wasn't around as much. He was in some ways an absentee dad in many ways. But when he was there, he was awfully deep in study because he had messages to prepare. He had radio programs to do. And so the image that I realized that I had of my dad was a closed office door. And what came to my mind was I had the same image of God as my father. That I've never doubted God's love for me. I've doubted God's existence, okay? I've doubted that. I've been there. Still sometimes go there. But I've always been convinced if God is there, he loves me. He's got to love me because I'm such an idiot sometimes. But the image was this closed office door of God as my father, that he's about really important things and busy doing other things. And really my stuff is a little bit trivial for him. And I had to learn to realize that God's office door is always open. That was a default setting that I had as a dad as well, going off to particularly to school, to seminary. And I realized this is one thing I had to change. And between Diane and myself, we talked about it. And I said, you know, I don't want to ever work behind a closed door. And I don't want my kids ever to be told that he's too busy. Don't bother him. And we followed that for the most part. And I said, by the way, if I look like I'm getting too caught up in my work or in my ministry or whatever, I want you to just say this to me. And it'll be code, but I'll understand what you're saying. I say, you just have to say, Don, you're starting to become a lot like your dad. And I'll probably get mad. I'll probably get ticked off at it, but I need to hear it. And I think she's only had to tell me that once or twice. And it's code for saying, you're not making yourself available enough. Remember what's important here. And that is your home life is more important than anything else. We can learn by watching others. I have to say that throughout the course of my life, I don't remember having, especially in the formative years of my life, a lot of men other than my dad that I looked to for shaping my understanding of what it meant to be a dad. And so what I've had to do is learn by the seat of my pants, as some of you probably have to learn too. And one of the conclusions I came to is, I learned a lot about being a dad through my children. Not from my children, okay, but through my children. And often it was by trial and error, and sometimes errors that I had to kind of rectify. But I also realized that over time, my focus shifted, especially when we started going through the rough years with Jonathan, shifted to a story that Jesus told about a dad and two sons. And it has become very personal to me because in some ways, not in the way that I think I'm God in that sense, but in some ways I've lived this story. We often call the story the parable of the prodigal son. But I want to suggest to you that's a total misnomer. That's totally misnamed. And this is how we often tell the story we hear it told, is that there was a dad with two boys, and the younger one asked for his share of the inheritance, and his dad gave him to him, and he goes off to a faraway country, lives a wild life, spends all that he has, finds himself broke and found down and out, and decides he needs to come home. He comes home, and his dad welcomes him with open arms and throws a big party for him. And often that's what we hear, that's where we stop, and the story simply becomes about this younger son who is referred to as a prodigal son. And, you know, by the way, when I went and looked up what prodigal meant, I realized it doesn't mean anything about what I thought it meant. And I thought it was pretty well-versed in the English language, but I always thought prodigal meant he was wayward. He went off, you know, because lost. You know, he went off and he was kind of doing his wild. That was about, but it really actually means is reckless abandon to how you spend money and your resources. And it can be both negative and positive. And the reason I looked up the word is because Tim Keller, Pastor Tim Keller, has written a book called Prodigal God, and I'm thinking, how can you call God prodigal? And he speaks of prodigal God because God is reckless in his love and his resources that he spends on us. Anyway, the story really is not only and not even primarily about the younger son, contrary to what we think. I've heard evangelistic messages preached on it, and I'm great when people come to, I don't care what you used, you know, how you use scripture, if people come to faith in Christ, fantastic, glory, hallelujah, amen, that's great. But it isn't the way Jesus tells it. It's actually told to people who were part of the Jewish culture, part of the Jewish religion. The central character in the story is actually the dad. And I think in many ways the story would be much better called maybe the story of a father and his two boys, his two sons, but even better yet, the story of the scandalous love of a father. Because when we hear the story the way Jesus told it, we begin to hear it through the ears and heart and mind of his original recipients and when the audience that was heard him tell the story for the first time, it is nothing but scandalous. It is shocking. It is totally counterculture. It is not politically correct. There's nothing right about it. They would have thought this is totally wrong. There's a lesson there for us to hear, by the way. Because sometimes we hear things and see things through our social, our cultural grid and perspective. And we are the ones that are wrong. We're hearing the wrong things. I think the other thing that happens is Jesus tells his stories sometimes in shocking ways because he engages, when he tells a story, he's inviting us, he's inviting his listeners, his hearers to enter into the story, to become part of that story, to find their place in the story, to perhaps identify themselves with one of the characters in the story. And it becomes a shocking reality that exposes parts of us, says something about us that often we don't want to know. And it's like, thank you, Jesus, for telling me what I didn't want to know about myself. This story is very much like that. So the principal character is this dad. And if anything, if any one of the boys is the main person that Jesus is referring to, it's not the younger son, it's actually the older son. And isn't it interesting that that's the part that we often don't tell, that we leave off. So today, what I want to do is tell the story. I want us to look at the story. It's in Luke chapter 15. If you have a Bible, you can look it up and and follow along. Luke chapter 15. And Luke, of course, is one of the first books, the third book in the New Testament. Your New Testament and your Bible comes about two-thirds of the way through your Bible. And there's four guys in a row that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they tell the story of Jesus' life and ministry, and Luke is number three. I like Luke because Luke was the non-Jew person who tells it from a different perspective and brings out different aspects of the life of Jesus. So Luke chapter 15, the story starts in verse 11 of Luke chapter 15. But it really need to refer back to the first couple verses because it gives the context in which Jesus is telling this story. And so I want to first look at the context, look at the audience, look what gave rise to Jesus telling stories. Because when Jesus told his parables and told his stories, it was to teach a particular point. And it was aimed at a particular audience. It would have been significant to the audience who was listening to him. I know we often take his parables and we make them say a whole lot of things. We kind of engage in an adventure missing the point when we do that. Because Jesus told stories usually for one main point. And his main point here was to correct the misunderstandings that so many, especially the religious people, had about who God is and what he is like. It's very different from the way we often hear the story. God, Jesus often told stories focused on correcting the thinking that people had of God as their Father, God as who he is. And I believe that's why we all need to pay close attention to some of these stories in a different way than we have in the past, because I think some of the same misunderstandings and misinterpretations take place today. And because we have a wrong understanding of who He is, God is, and what He is like, we don't have that kind of relationship with God that He invites us to have. Because most often our misunderstandings and misinterpretations often keep God at a distance as opposed to an intimate part of our lives. Jesus, by the way, was radically different in His day and age for addressing God as Father. Now, in the Old Testament, sometimes we find kind of general references to God, the fatherhood of God. But none of the Jews, they would not have dared to or attempted to address God as Father. But Jesus teaches us to pray. He teaches that there's this relationship that God wants with us as a father with His children. Now again, I understand, okay? I understand that when our image of fatherhood is corrupted by having a dysfunctional dad our experience in life, that can change and affect how we live and experience God as Father. So my encouragement to you is not to look at your earthly father, no matter even how good he was, as an image of what God is like as a father, but rather look at God as a father as how and what it means to be a dad, to be a father. And particularly as men, we need to pay close attention to this in terms of how we live our lives in relationship to our wives and our children. So let me read the first couple of verses, and then I'll talk briefly about them, and then we'll move into the story itself. Excuse me a minute. So Luke says this. He says, "Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him," that is Jesus, "but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, 'This man welcomes sinners and eats with them.'" And then it goes on to say, "And then Jesus told them this parable." And what follows is a series of three parables, three stories, the third of which is the one that we're going to look at more in depth here. But I want you to notice the audience and the reason what gave rise to Jesus telling the story. It says the tax collectors and the sinners were gathering around. Wherever Jesus went, he attracted this crowd. That has always occurred to me, for some reason or other, our churches never attract. That ought to make us sit up and pay attention, by the way. It is that the very people that found Jesus most attractive are probably some of the people that find church least attractive. We should have warning flags going off about that. Tax collectors and sinners. So who were these people? Well, sinners kind of is in some ways self-explanatory, but sometimes we think of that as being like the down and out, you know, like the drug addicts, the drunks. They were not totally that way. There were people who lived a lifestyle apart from God being a part of that. They have chosen to live a lifestyle as they please rather than following God's purpose and direction and standard for their lives. There's a lot of good living people who do the same thing today. But there's a special category even below sinners that was reserved for tax collectors. Now, we have to put this into context because okay, we may not have a great appreciation for the CRA, although I have to tell you that we live in a country that is as good it is because we pay taxes and our taxes work for us. We have a medical system that actually functions, and no matter what people's complaints have been about it, a whole lot better than it does to our neighbors to the south because we pay taxes. So paying taxes isn't the problem here, and Jesus never kind of condemned paying taxes. So who are these tax collectors? Well, in Jesus' day, the tax collectors were seen as traitors. Israel at that time was being occupied by a foreign power, the Romans. And the Romans had this way of kind of controlling situations. You got to remember that the Roman Empire extended at its greatest, extended from what is today Great Britain all the way to India. That's a vast amount of territory. Even today, that would be a huge amount of territory to try to govern and to control. So the way they did that is, often by shipping people out and shipping new people in, but they also contracted with people, local people, to help them control things. So they needed a fair bit of tax money to be able to operate as controlling factors to keep their armies going. And so they contracted it out to local people, to local Jews, to collect taxes for them. And here's the carrot, so to speak, you know, what made it lucrative. They said, we just want this part of our tax, and whatever else you charge on top of that, that's up to you. Because the tax collectors were notorious not for only collecting what needed to be turned over to the Romans, but collecting over and above. And it was a means by which they got rich at the expense of their own people. So tax collectors were the lowest of low, because they were seen as having formed a partnership with the foreign occupying forces. They were seen as ripping off their own people and getting rich at the expense of that, and then working together with foreign forces. One of the things you need to notice about these two categories, tax collectors and sinners, is that according to the religious people, the religious leaders, which I'll get to here in a minute, they were totally unacceptable to God. Their lifestyle was one that was totally unacceptable to God. And furthermore, that meant they were excluded from any kind of temple worship. They were not welcomed into the temple courts. They could not enter into those gates because their lifestyle and who they were, what they did, prevented them from being eligible to enter into worship. Aren't you glad we don't have that? At least we don't have any written ones. Sometimes we seem to have some things that prevent people from coming into worship. But these were very strong feelings that they had. This group would have felt unwanted by God, unacceptable to God, and basically not having any expectation or hope that anything would ever change for them. So if you want to think about it and put yourself into that kind of situation, think about it as somebody who has become a drug addict, lives on the streets downtown, and really has absolutely no hope, no expectation of even living any length of time this life, but no hope of change. Once people were categorized in a certain way, they were rejected, they were ostracized, they were marginalized. It is this group that found themselves attracted to Jesus because he offered forgiveness, he welcomed them into the kingdom of God, he loved them. So the other group that shows up here are the Pharisees and the teacher of the law. Now I know in the Christian church today we talk about Pharisees in a negative light, but in Jesus' day, to be a Pharisee was something to be proud of. Paul was a Pharisee, and he boasted about the fact that, you know, as a Pharisee, he was without fault. And in other words, the Pharisees kept the law right to the most nth degree. You know, just they split hairs over making sure they kept the law. If God said don't, you know, you're to rest on the Sabbath, that meant no work. They even defined and determined how many steps you could take on a Sabbath, that if you took over that many, it would constitute work. Good thing they didn't have pedometers in those days. You know, they would have probably been checking everybody's pedometer every so often. This is work. They live the absolute clean, correct life. And so for them, as they looked at Jesus welcoming all these that whom they thought by their honest belief system, okay, these are the Pharisees and the teachers, they're good people. They look at Jesus as saying, you're bending the rules, you're breaking it, this is no good. How can you be a prophet? How can you speak for God if you allow for all of this? And so they are grumbling about it, and they say, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. And you have to realize that eating with them isn't like kind of stopping in at McDonald's and having a burger with somebody. But having a meal with somebody was an invitation to a relationship. It still is in many parts of the world. It is in the part of the world where I grew up. And it became very frustrating to Western businessmen who would want to fly in for the day, do a business deal, and fly out afterwards. And it just doesn't happen that in some of these cultures. You come in, we build a relationship, which means that we eat a meal together. You might eat in my home, not out in a restaurant. and we talk about our families and we get to know each other. And then I decide if I really want to do business with you. It's not the bottom line like it is here that makes a difference in making that business deal. It's whether we can actually connect on a relational side. And so when Jesus is eating with these tax collectors and sinners, he's inviting them into this close personal relationship with him. And so these religious people, the religious right, complain about that and say, this is all wrong. Keep this in mind, because it's in answer to this that Jesus tells three stories. One is about a lost coin, one is about a lost sheep, and then this one is, well, about a lost son. But it's about more than a lost son. So when you have that perspective in mind, that Jesus is trying to actually address this mindset of the Pharisees and the religious leaders, that we can begin to understand what the story means to them. And so let's read about it. Let's read it. Let me clarify some things along the way that they would have heard Jesus saying that today we don't necessarily hear him saying, because we have a different cultural perspective that doesn't kind of encompass that and allow us to hear that and see that, unless we read it and hear it through the ears and the minds and the hearts of a first century Jew. So Jesus continued after telling these first two stories, and he said, there was a man who had two sons. The man who had two sons. The father is the first person mentioned here, and he's the last one to speak. He's emphasizing that this is about the man, not the two sons. And then he says, the younger son once said to his father, Father, give me a share of the estate. And so he divided his property between them. Now, we just see the youngest son coming and saying, you know, I want my share of inheritance early, you know, and dad goes and cashes in his stocks, pays them out, and he's good to go. That is not what they're hearing. One is, this is a shocking statement, a shocking request. It's actually a demand. The way Jesus words it, the younger son isn't saying, could I have my share of the inheritance? He says, give me my share of the inheritance. It's a demand that he's placing before his dad. That was a cause, that was an attitude of rebellion. And in Jesus' day, his listeners hearing that would have been shocked, because it was incredible that anybody, any son, would ever even make that request, even though it might be on his mind. But what it took to, the incredible audacity that it took to actually go to his father and say that. Because essentially what the younger son is saying to his dad, I wish you were dead. Why don't you die? Because then I can cash in on what I'm going to get from you as inheritance once you die. I have no need for you in this life. You're only as good as the money that I'm going to inherit from you. You know what? I have known in the course of my ministry here, sad to say, children of very respectable people who all they saw their parents was good for was their inheritance when they died. We have all kinds of battles over wills these days because of that kind of greed. So we're not as shocked by that, because it is part of our life, our culture, in many ways, to be that greedy. But in Jesus' day, this was a shocking statement. And the natural response his listeners would have thought of the dad was that he should have taken out his cane and he should have just beat the crap out of this guy. He should have kicked him out of the house and sent him packing. There's no way that he should have even allowed him, because just making the request brought shame onto the family, brought shame onto the community, brought shame onto the father. It's a very shocking thing that we need to hear through their eyes, their ears, to say, there's no way. You got to be kidding. But what is equally shocking, and even more so, is what the dad does. He doesn't argue with the son. He doesn't try to reason with him. He doesn't do anything of that. He just says, he divided his property between them. That is, between the younger and the older son. Now, in that time, the older son would have, as the eldest son, would have qualified for an extra measure of the inheritance. The older son would have gotten 2/3, the younger son would have gotten 1/3. And it seems the younger son was quite content to get his third, and that's all. He just wanted to be on his own. What is interesting is also the words that Jesus uses here that gets lost a little bit in translation, because when the son comes to his dad and asks for his share of the estate, he's using a word that refers to the property and the wealth. It seems pretty obvious from the story, the way Jesus tells it, that this family was very well off. They were one of the top-ranking families in the community. They would have had a fair, significant amount of property. They would have been fairly wealthy. They would have been of fairly high social economic standing in the community itself. And so when the son comes, he just sees it in monetary, material terms. He says, give me my share of the estate, the material aspect, the wealth, the money, the financial aspect. When the son, when Jesus says the father divides up what he has, the word he uses for that is a word from which it conveys a sense that this is his whole life achievement or accomplishment. It's what he divides up is not just his land, it is not just a sense of the land, but his whole life is divided up between his two sons. We see property most often in terms of dollars and cents and value, especially in Metro Vancouver, where property is extravagantly high. And if you're fortunate enough to own something, that's significant. But land and property in the first century and for the Jews was more than monetary value. It represented their part of being part of the promised land, part of a people. There was a connection with the land that went beyond just owning something and its monetary value. So when families sold off part of their land, it was like selling part off part of their life. It was like giving away part of your life. And so when the son asks for his share and the father sells it off or gets kind of turns it into cash so he can pay him out, he's like giving away, selling off part of his life. What is interesting, he actually divides it up among his two sons, which means that leaves the father with nothing. These are all important things, because when Jesus' first audience was listening, these would have been extremely shocking statements for them to hear about happen. There's no way that can happen. That's incredible. We would never allow for it. What happens here is that the father, by selling off and giving it away, his position, his status in the community drops significantly. The fact that he gives into the request or the demand of his son destroys his whole credibility in the community. We often don't see it that way, that the father brings all kinds of shame upon himself and his family by actually following through with what the younger son demands. We don't have a culture of shame. Some of you have grown up in cultures that at least have some roots in that kind of sense, that there is a sense of what your children do brings shame to the family. We sort of do. We say tell our kids they reflect on us. But it's a different factor. We don't quite understand that concept. But in Jesus' day, that was significant. And that's what his listeners would have heard him saying. So he sells it. Well, goes on to the next section. And Jesus says, well, not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Now, if you were in the audience listening to Jesus, you would start nodding your head. Yep, that's what happens, you know. Kid, headstrong, gets his own way. Stupid kid, goes off, doesn't have the wisdom to even use what he was given properly. Just squanders it, wastes it all. That's what happens. There's some key things here that I don't want to skip over. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on it. It says when he sets off for a distant country, there is a sense that it's geographic and physical distance he's going off to a country. But he's creating for himself a physical geographic separation from his family. You see, when the younger son has come to his father and asked for his inheritance early while his father's still alive, he's not only saying, I wish you were dead. He's actually saying, I no longer want to be part of this family. I no longer want to be connected with you or my brother. I don't want to be connected with anything but this. And so he sets off, and he sets off to make life the way he wants it. And so he spends what he has quite wildly. We often say, easy come, easy go. As long as he has, you know, the funds and resources to have parties, he probably has friends. And then as soon as it runs out, his friends run out too. Not unusual. And so Jesus' audience would have been sitting there listening to all this, and they would have been nodding their heads solemnly. Yeah, that's the expected results and consequences of this behavior. He spirals down, and he hits the lowest of lows. He's a Jewish boy. The Jews would have nothing. They didn't, not only did not eat pig, pork, they would not have anything to do with pigs. So to find himself in a position where he has to look for work, chances are he hasn't had a job in the day, worked a day in his life, except for maybe for his father in different ways on his estate. Probably has no skills to market to get anything more. Does the only thing he can. And he hires himself out. And in essence, he sells himself out to work for somebody who doesn't have the same values he has, doesn't have the religious principles that he does, doesn't believe the same way he does. And he has to do whatever he's told him to do. And he ends up feeding the pigs and finds himself in a situation where he's in need, he can't even find enough to cover his own needs, even probably from what he's being paid to do, what he does. It's at that point that Jesus goes on and says, when he came to his senses, literally Jesus, when he came to himself, when he also came to have this full awareness of where he was, what had happened, and come to the full awareness of where his state in life was, he said to himself, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. And so he got up and went to his father. He comes to himself. And someplace in his process and thinking, he realizes where he's at. He gets a grasp on where he's at. He bottoms out. One of the main steps is to reach that point. You know, when you have an addiction, you have to go through that recovery process to reach to the point that you can't do anything for yourself. You've bottomed out. You have to hit rock bottom. He's bottomed out. Someplace in Teresa's mind, he knows what kind of man his father is. He knows his dad to be a gracious, compassionate, and very generous person who looks after his staff, his hired hands, his slaves. He provides for them and takes good care of them. And so he takes stock of his situation and he said, I've given up my sonhood. There's no way that I can work my way back into being part of the family. That's true enough. But if I can get back home, maybe my dad will hire me to work for him, not to bring me back into the household, because there's no way I deserve that. There is no expectation. Remember, part of the audience listening is, are the tax collectors and sinners who've been taught all their way, all their life, have been told God doesn't love you, doesn't accept you, you are rejected forever. He represents those who feels himself, he's beyond the point of no return to his original position and status as a valuable part of the family. He can no longer expect to be taken back in. He's not expecting that. He's not asking for that. He's lost any kind of hope that that might be even a remote possibility. Right now, it's just survival. It's just making sure, how do I live through this, and how do I get back on my feet so I can actually even look after myself? Well, I remember those who worked for my dad, they were well taken care of. They were able to at least live day to day without the worries and anxieties and the needs that I have here that aren't being met. And so he comes up with this speech that he's going to do to try to convince his dad to take him back in. Remember, he's in a distant country. I think every step of the way, and he probably didn't even have anything to eat on the way home. Who knows how long it took him to come. Every step of the way, he's rehearsing the step. Have you done that? You know, you have to make this difficult phone call to somebody. You rehearse what you in your mind, you just keep going over and over. This is what I'm going to say. Or you have employees that you're a boss and you have employees and you have to say, so you have to have that difficult conversation with somebody who works for you. Or you're a parent, you have to have that difficult conversation with children, or as a child, you have to have that difficult conversation with a parent, and you rehearse, you go over and over in your mind so that you get it down pat, so you know what you're going to say when they happen to be in front of you, so you can say what you need to say, what you think you need to say. And I think that's where this younger son is at. And so he makes his way back home. But while he was still a long way off, it says, Jesus says, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. While he was still far away off, his father saw him. Again, you know, it's easy to overlook something that's taking place here. His father saw him. Because he was looking for him. His father had the expectation, the hope, that the day would come when his son would make his way home while he was far off. Another explanation actually I saw of this, where he went out to look for him and saw him and ran to him, was by somebody who'd worked in the Middle East a lot and had learned a lot about the culture. And he said the father saw him, ran to him and embraced him and escorted him home, because this younger son would have not only brought shame on his family, on his father and his family, but shame on the community. And the odds are pretty good that if others saw him coming at first, they would go out meet him, but they would not be embracing him. They would be turning him away. They would go out to beat him up and send him, get out of here. You're not part of our community anymore. You're not welcome here. And so part of his father seeing him and running out to him is, yes, out of love and compassion, but also to protect him. Now, again, men with any amount of dignity did not run in that age. Children ran. Sometimes mothers ran. Men, grown men, did not run. Because to run, the weather garb, they had to kind of hitch up whatever their clothes were so that they wouldn't trip over it. It was just totally undignified. And so the image that Jesus is portraying here is that to the Father, his love for his son overrides shame, overrides loss of dignity, overrides humiliation, overrides everything. It is a scandalous love that the Father has for his younger son. And so he runs out to him. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. He launches into this speech that he's already been rehearsing, been practicing all the way home. And he launches into it, but his father interrupts him, doesn't even let him get it all out. You wonder if the father is even hearing what he's saying. He's just so happy to see him there. He interrupts him. And the father, he turns to his servants and he says, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on and put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine who was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And so they begin to celebrate. The best robe was probably the father's own robe that was reserved for ceremonial and special occasions. And he said, give him the place of honor. Put my robe on him. The ring that they would have put on the finger was the probably the signet ring of the family, that every family had a signet ring with a bit of a coat of arms, some kind of mark that was their family code mark that when they sealed business deals, they used that ring to in hot wax to seal a business deal. The ring conveyed restoring him as a son with full authority as part of the family. And sandals, again, indicated honor, because to go barefoot was humiliating, was to be humiliated and to be poor and to not be respected. I don't know what this is for me. I like going barefoot. But in his day, it was a little bit different. He didn't go around barefoot. I wear sandals. But the cloak, the ring, the sandals. But then to top it off, he says, go kill the fatted calf. And let's party, let's celebrate. Again, something we get lost here, because we eat beef, well, maybe not every day, because it gets pretty pricey for that too. They didn't eat beef very often. Actually, when I came across this part of the story, it reminded me of going to Cuba, when we go where, you know, beef is reserved for tourists, for the special honored guests. And it was the same thing here in this day, is that this fat calf, it was reserved for that special ceremonial celebration occasion. Maybe it was a wedding feast. Maybe it was the arrival of some ranking high authority in the land. And then you kill the fat calf and you partied. Can you imagine? You had to invite the whole community out to party, because there would be that much food there. Let's celebrate, because this, my son, that's significant. My son was dead, but is alive again. You see, really what happened is when the son wanted his inheritance, and basically was saying, I wish you were dead, my dad. It was he who died in many ways, because he died to the relationship. He cut off that relationship with his family, in particular with his dad. And for all intents and purposes at that point, it was like he was dead to the family. They had no contact with him. They lost touch with him. They didn't know if he was dead or alive. They didn't know where he was, how he was going, what was taking place in his life. And for all intents and purposes, he was the one that was dead. And so the father welcomes him, because he said, my son who was dead is alive again. He was totally hopelessly lost, but he's been found. So let's celebrate. Now, like I've said before, we often stop when we tell the story, we hear the story told, that's often where it stops. And it's like they partied and they lived happily ever after, but that's really not what happens, is it? Because Jesus goes on to say, meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and the dancing. And so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Notice what the servant says. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in. And I think at this point, Jesus' audience is saying, well, yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. That is just totally wrong what the father's doing. The older son has every right to be angry. Remember, when the father divided up the estate, he gave the older son his part of the estate. He gave the younger brother his part of the estate, which meant that the father was left with nothing in terms of his own sense of owning. He probably still carried out that sense of authority as a father, but he didn't have necessarily total control over the wealth and over the property. And the older son now here is a little bit angry about it because he's done something that he obviously is not in agreement with, but without even consulting him. And when he hears his younger brother coming home, he's thinking, oh no, he's going to want part of my estate, my share of the estate now too. And so with almost justifiable reason, these Jesus audience would have been saying, well, yeah, he's angry. He has every right to be angry. And he's got every right to refuse to go in and celebrate because this is not something worth celebrating. His father is all wrong about how he's going out of it. Remember, this story is meant to shock into reality for people to find their place in the story, to shock them, because Jesus will bring a different turn to it as well. So he refused to go in. So his father, who's inside, went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fat calf for him. Notice the terminology that he uses. He doesn't even have the courtesy or the respect to address his father as father. He says, look, it's like, look, you. This is the ultimate way of being disrespectful in addressing his father. In essence, he is bringing more shame on his father by the way he's addressing it. He doesn't refer to his brother. Remember, the servant says, your brother has come home and your father. He doesn't even address his father now as his father anymore. And he doesn't refer to his brother as his brother. He says, this son of yours. He is disconnecting himself in a different way, but just as much disconnecting himself from the father and from the family, from his younger brother, from everything to do with, as did the younger brother. And this is the point that Jesus wants to drive home, because the older son says, I have obeyed you, I've done everything right, I've served you, I've done all these things, and you didn't even give me a goat to celebrate with. The younger son had a spirit of entitlement when he asked for his share of the inheritance. No question about it. There was a spirit of entitlement. He says, I am entitled to this. Give it to me. But the older son has an equally sense of entitlement. It's just that he thinks he's earned that entitlement by being obedient, by living a good life, by following his father's orders, by serving him. But you see, both these boys missed out on the fact that the father simply wants a relationship with them, and both have missed out because both are using the father to get their own means. Doesn't that sound like a lot of us, how we use God? Look, I've done everything right. I attend church every Sunday. I give generously. I pray. I read my Bible. And yet you let this happen to me. What's up with that, God? I'm entitled to better treatment than that, God. The father pleads with him, but he refuses. Notice the answer that the father says, and I will bring this in for a landing here. He says, my son. See, the father does not disconnect himself as father from the younger son, but he doesn't from the older son, no matter how they disrespect him, no matter how much shame they bring on his name, no matter how they treat him, my son. Dads, we are dads for better or for worse. At some point you go through the for worse. I've been through that. And you all either allow your love to grow or you become bitter and angry and resentful. What I see in the father here is love, yes, scandalous love, because it's not deserved, but that's what love is all about. It's not given because it's deserved or earned. It's just given because. My son, the father says, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate. There's a sense of compulsion that Jesus wants these religious leaders to get a handle on, is that when sinners and tax collectors, when are found, when they return home, it is a cause to celebrate. When the lost are found, when the dead are brought back to life, spiritual life, it is a reason to celebrate. He said, because this brother of yours, see, the father refuses to acknowledge that they are not brothers anymore. He says, this brother of yours was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found. The story is left hanging. Isn't that frustrating sometimes? I can imagine Jesus' disciples often thought, oh no, here he goes, launches off into another story. Just answer the question. But he tells a story, puts a twist on it, and then he leaves it hanging. The way, you know, some TV shows end. Will the younger son actually amount to much? Will he stay with the program, or will he go off the deep end again? Will the older son actually go into the party and celebrate with him? Will they live happily ever after, or will they part company and all kind of live their life off in austerity and far from each other? I think there's a reason why Jesus doesn't put a conclusion to the story. You see, you and I, as well as his listeners at that time, we are the conclusion. Remember, he tells a story, and as Jesus tells his story, he's inviting you and me and all those who listen and hear the story to find their place in the story, to say, who do you most identify with in this story? And as you find your place and identify the story, you bring the story to conclusion. If you're the older brother, and can I say, I think most of us are the older brother, not the younger brother. Do you go in and party? Do you go in to celebrate? Do you welcome and embrace those who are different? Smell bad? I don't care. You know, eat the wrong foods, drink the wrong liquids, live the wrong way. Do you embrace them as brothers and sisters in the same family? The question is there. If you've experienced God's grace as the younger brothers, do you embrace it and live out of a heart filled with gratitude that then serves God's purposes, not your own selfish means? I think Jesus intentionally leaves his story without a conclusion because he's inviting us to bring it to the conclusion. But I think the thing that I want to also point out is that he's showing the religious leaders that the same love, scandalous love and grace of the Father that is demonstrated and poured out on the younger son is there for them too. You know, they're like the older son. We've obeyed you. We've kept you to the nth of the law. What's in it for us? And he's saying, forget that. Embrace the relation with a God who loves you for who you are, not for how you live, not for what you are. Yes, he wants to see your life change. You know, we have the saying, right? God loves you just the way you are. He loves you too much to leave you the way you are. But let that be the work of the Spirit in your life. That isn't a product of just working harder to earn God's favor. We don't come to God out of faith and repentance and receive his grace and mercy and then from there on try to earn his acceptance and his welcoming and his praise. We simply live out of hearts of gratitude. When I was driving transit, well, bus, highway bus out of Regina, one of the, Regina is kind of on one of the flattest parts of this earth. I don't blame people for being flat earth if they're thinking if they come from Saskatchewan or that part of Saskatchewan. Other parts are different. And you could clear Moose Jaw, which is still about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour outside of Regina. And especially if it was coming at night, with often that's the case, I was coming in late at night. and I could see the lights. There's this glow of lights that kind of rose up over Regina and reflected into the skies. And it kept me going that last hour because I was almost home. It's the lights of home that says, you're welcome here. At the worst of times in my son's life, and we still do this, we kept lights on, both front porch and back porch. They burn all night. And Dinah would put a candle in the window. The message is, the light is on, you're welcome, come home. I think with God as our Father, it's the same. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what's happened in your life. It doesn't matter what you're doing right now. It doesn't matter where you've been. The lights are on. They say, come home. You're always welcome. We're welcome home. Here's the last thing I want to say, and then I'll step down. You and I, as followers of Jesus, Jesus said, you are the lights of this world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand and it gives light to everyone in the house. And in the same way, let your light shine before men that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. We are the lights of home that say to people who are far from God, you're welcome. Come on in. You too are part of the family. Just come on in. Will we let our light shine? Will we accept the invitation of Jesus to start out with, to come home if we're far from him? And then will we be part of the light that shines in the window of home that invites others who are lost and far from God and tells them they can find a place because God is their faithful Father who is always there to welcome them home. My prayer in closing, as always, that you would come into a fresh experience of your Father in heaven who has an awesome and even scandalous love for you. It's not based on who you are, what you've done, what you have to give back. It's just because he loves you. He's demonstrated that through Jesus Christ. And his invitation is to receive his love with open arms, to embrace that. Allow it to transform you from the inside out. Because I'm convinced that when we come into this experience of God's awesome, scandalous love for us, we become loving people in a very awesome and scandalous way too. And it's only as we experience that and we're transformed by that love that we're then empowered to be world changers, even. And that begins with the place where you live, the place where you work, the place where you play, the place where you study. And you just connect with what God is already doing there through the power of his Spirit. May that be your experience today. And from this day forward, go in peace.